Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to heritageradionetwork.org, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station. We're millions strong, with folks tuning in from over 200 countries. We are education. We are entertainment. We are the future of food. May is our membership drive. Become a member and support us while receiving e-newsletters, advanced invites, special discounts, and a membership card. We need your support. Visit our website and click the donate button to become a member today. Thank you for believing in us and enjoy the show.
Chef's Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today we're broadcasting from the International Culinary Center, and we have one of New York's best chefs with us, probably one of the country's best chefs, if not the world, and one of my favorite fun people because she says lots of things just like it is, and she's probably known to many of you from being on Chopped, The Best Thing I Ever Ate, all over the TV Food Network and Bravo. We have Alex Guarnicelli with us today. Hi, Alex, and welcome.
Thank you.
So we've known each other a long time.
It's
I'm
true.
So happy to have you here.
Thank you.
Today. So, wow. I mean, you're so inspirational for, you know, this is a cooking school, and we have a lot of women who are here, and men. And your background, you really paid your dues. You know, you're a career changer. You went to Barnard.
Mm-hmm.
You started your career really working with Larry Forgione.
Right? I did.
You did. But then you went to Lovarin in Paris.
I did.
You did. And you worked in France. Mm-hmm. And I always remember you telling me the stories about France. And we're going to get into that a little later on. But you've really been able to, today, manage a great restaurant, be the executive chef, and do all of this media, and you're a mom.
Yeah.
You know, you're doing it all. I think there's a lot of people out there that want to understand how do you do it and what makes you tick. So let's start when you were a little kid.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a famous mom
who's a
food editor, and she's iconic. What was it like growing up with a mother who's the iconic food editor? What kind of food did you eat in your house, and what are your food memories?
Well, I would say the first way to be successful in growing up with someone iconic is to not know that they're iconic and that they're always just mom. That kind of helps the situation. But I'd say, you know, I feel like chefs in particular, but I think everyone has a culinary identity that they base somewhat on their childhood and the sort of repertoire of dishes that they were exposed to. And I would say in a lot of cases, people feel, or whether they're aware of it or not, feel that that repertoire was somewhat consistent. It had a consistent message, and it came from, say, a couple of cultural origins, maybe the mother and the father, or an aunt, or an uncle, or whomever. But I'd say in my case, my parents are both Italian, so we're an Italian-American family. People say to us, oh, you're Italian, and we say, we're Italian-American. You know, we almost don't want to disrespect Italy by saying that we're true Italians. But here's the thing. I mean, yeah, there was this sort of parade of Italian dishes that sort of always hung around.
Like what?
My mom made a lot of sort of a lot of those kind of torta di ricottas, those kind of ricotta torts, and a lot of cheesecakes, very Italian-style cheesecakes, which, God bless, I never really cared for. There is actually something on the earth that I don't want to eat. But my father really loved that. She made those things for my father, and it was really kind of so fun to watch him eat them. That, you know, but they had that diced up citrus and everything that I feel is really a truly Italian flavor, because it sort of got that pleasant bitterness. I don't think we as Americans could really say bitter goes much beyond coffee, or that we would oftentimes seek it deliberately.
Is that Sicilian?
Definitely. Yeah, definitely.
I was going to say those candied.
Oh, yeah. You can go to DiPaolo's and get it still in the most beautiful form possible. So there was a lot of that. And my father sort of was much more the meatball and pasta domain. My mom didn't really dabble in that. And the red sauce scenario was really left to my father. I think it's because my father makes better tomato sauce than my mother, because he understands how important a little sugar is for all tomatoes in the universe. But he also made some sort of what he called Italian peasant dishes, so to speak. Things like he would make a simple risotto with arborio rice and just add tomato sauce to it, and that would be the whole dish. And it was just sort of soaked in there. And I have these sort of memories of such simple dishes, and not really identifying them as Italian, just identifying them as what I had last Tuesday. But despite all that, I think what was sort of confusing, complex, and overall really sort of compelling for me as a child was my mother sort of became immersed in whatever manuscript she was working on. And every manuscript, she took so much time to edit them. Her process really involved cooking a lot of the recipes from the book intensively over a short period of time. So she did classic Indian cooking, I think, in 1978, and we just ate all of Julie Sani's recipes, I mean, for months. And then my father said, I can't have another dal. I can't see the word garam masala again for a while. And so then she got, and I don't remember the exact order, though I could look. There was the year of that. There was the year of The Splendid Table and Rosetto Casper. So that was Emilia Romagna. My father said, if I see balsamic vinegar or Parmigiano Reggiano, I'm going to lose it. I mean, imagine eating so much of it that you would actually say such blasphemous things. And then there was the year of the Rose Levy Birnbaum Cake Bible. That was a tough one.
My gosh, how do you work your way through that? Because that is some tome.
I mean, yeah. First of all, you know, Rose will sift something 100 times. I don't know if you know this, but Rose Birnbaum wrote her thesis on sifting flour. So no. You're not dealing with any normal human being there. And I mean that in the best sense of the word normal. And the thing that's, you know, may not be so surprising is that my mom thought she was normal, you know, and the two of them were just kind of like, of course, you're dissecting.
My favorite Rose story is that she wanted to buy an oven, and she had all these food friends, and she lives in the village, and so she would make, in her apartment, the cake batter, and she'd get in a taxi and go to one of her friends and stick it in their oven, and then test it when it came out to see which oven was the best, and she could never make the cake batter there because it would be different, because the water in that apartment would be different. So she always made the cake batter at home, got in a taxi, and that was her, you know. You are right.
And by the way, that sounds a little blasé for the Rose that I came to know. Well, she sounds so lazy. So, you know, my mom just baked this steady stream of cakes and, you know, was measuring everything to the gram, and those were really sublime.
So were you rebelling against this? Were you cooking with her?
No.
Were you eating it and saying, gee, Mom, this is great, what's your next book?
No, none of those things, honestly. I wasn't, I meet so many kids today, you know, 12-year-olds that say, I know I want to be a chef, I know already. And so I didn't. And didn't give it any thought, and would really like to sit here and say to you, you know what, from the minute I was 8, I knew, it would be utterly a lie. So I didn't look at it in any organized way.
What did you want to be when you were 8?
I really wanted to be a marine biologist.
Oh.
I want to go in search of that giant squid. I like sharks a lot. I might have been an ichthyologist, I think. I think I would have really gone into that field.
Why didn't you?
I think I decided I'd rather cook it than study it. I think that's what happened.
So a marine biologist, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'm particularly fascinated with sharks. And meanwhile, I can't go in over my shins in the ocean without quivering in fear. That's probably another reason. But when
was
I was...
this from watching Jaws or something like that?
It is, and it's also, I think, and this may sound crazy, but I don't think... I've cut and cooked so much fish that I sort of feel like karma payback would come if I went swimming. You know, like, she's finally here. No, I mean it. That girl in the beginning of Jaws running on the beach.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't have that bathing suit or that bikini body, but I've got all the trappings of that woman nonetheless.
Yeah.
So I wanted to be a marine biologist, but I'm not scientifically inclined beyond mm-hmm. biology. Mm-hmm.
They don't teach it at Barnard.
Funny, I don't think I paid any attention to what you could or couldn't study, and I also don't think that I really linked my education to what I was going to do with my life after the fact.
How did you wind up at Barnard?
I went to Horace Mann in the Bronx and applied to a number of schools, didn't get into a lot of them, let me tell you. So there was a little bit of a panic attack, because my parents are total academics. I mean, everything mm-hmm. is... academia.
What'd your father do?
My father's a retired professor of history.
Oh.
I wrote the application to Barnard, and I think because I wasn't even really terribly aware of what it was, because it was so nearby. I grew up in Midtown Manhattan. You know, sort of like, oh, you never go to the coffee shop that's on your corner.
Right.
You know, you live there.
Right.
So sort of like that, and then all of a sudden I was kind of realized what kind of environment Barnard was and what it had to offer, and mm-hmm. tried to shape up in a hurry. And I thought, well, I really love New York and I want to be here, you know? And my parents said, you know, we don't want you to live at home. We don't expect you to, you know, you can act like you're off at college even though you're nearby. And I did. And I studied art history because I always liked art, and I like going to the museum. I like looking at paintings. I didn't make my decision with any more complexity than that. Again, an answer, much more sort of informed answer is what I would like to give you, and it just would be a lie.
No, you know what? I think everybody's thinking from the minute you're born, you have to get on the career track, and everybody should know what they're doing, and the efficiency has to be there. And that's not what education is. Education's supposed to be, I don't know what I am. I need to be opened and exposed to all these different, you know, new things. And it strikes me that, and you can hear it in your voice and just your attitude, that you're a highly evolved, educated person. And isn't that what college is supposed to be about? I mean,
I think so.
I keep telling my daughter's in college now. I keep saying, she goes, oh, I don't know what to... I said, take everything. This is your time to experiment, try different courses. You don't know what you're going to like. You know, you have the privilege, you know, that you can take a few years and study a lot of different things. But anyway, getting back, so where were you eating up in Morningside Heights? I'm sure the food...
Oh, my God. I had no money. So I ate ramen noodles. I ate rice-a-roni. I ate a lot of fruit. I ate a lot of Captain Crunch. I'm not going to lie. I really did. I ate like your classic college student in it
so,
to gain
so
the freshman 20.
So when you left home, it wasn't, oh, I miss mom's, doll. you just...
No, I think I thought it was refreshing, actually, not to, you know, think so much about it and not have everything I eat be so cerebral or informed with 400 years of history.
Right.
But, I mean, I went home and my mom was cooking when I was in school, and I cooked a lot in my dorm room. I made a lot of lasagna, I baked cakes, I did stuff like that when I felt like it. Mm. And by the way, I would cook a bunch of stuff, and then I wouldn't cook for 3 weeks, and
right.
then I would pick it up again. So,
right.
like anything else, it ebbs and flows.
Right. Right. So when you got out of college, what did you do?
I thought, well, what the hell am I going to do now? You know what I mean?
Like any college graduate, except if they started at 8 years old and were on a career track.
Yeah. But I recognize now that I'm so glad I had the freedom of getting an education without being encumbered by these thoughts of what I actually intended to do with it. I never for once thought that I would do anything in the field of art history. I think vaguely I had a fantasy when I was a sophomore in college that I would restore the Sistine ceiling single-handedly and that I would, you know, win an Oscar and just everybody would love me and I would be the president and the queen of England and all those other things. But I was otherwise really unencumbered when I got my education. I'm glad for that. And art history is an excellent major because you can nap in the dark during the slideshows after lunch. And I did a lot of that. I napped a lot. I woke up, you know, usually I fell asleep when they were going over the Parmigianino slides. And by the time I woke up, we were all the way at Monet. So I made sure I missed that little chunk there in the middle. It's only a few hundred years. And then...
So you knew you didn't want to teach, right?
I did, actually. I think I thought, well, my father was such a good teacher. I think that was probably on my to-do list or hope, you know, that... But I think I also imagined that in many fields you end up teaching in some form or another, whether formally or not. But I woke up on graduation day and I said, you know what, you're going to pick your career by the end of the day and that's it. You have one day to pick it and that's it.
You're kidding me.
No, and I woke up and I said, I don't really like to do anything and I don't want to do anything, but I do like to cook. So, and my father always said, just imagine, pick something that you know you wouldn't mind doing 12 hours a day. He said, because that's what it ends up being. He said, and ideally you should like it. Oh, well, so simple and to the point. And so I thought, well, I kind of like cooking, you know. I think that would be cool. And it's easy. Oh, my God. Can you believe I said that?
That shows you how naive you were.
Oh, yeah. It's easy.
It's easy to watch your mom cook in an apartment where
that's
it's
right.
Therapy. It's, you know, it's therapy. It's a huge difference to professional cooking. Well, look, we're going to have to take a little break here. And when
okay.
we come back, we're going to talk about how you got into professional cooking.
I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years, so it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Listening to Chef Story. And this is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today my guest is Alex Granicelli, and we're at the International Culinary Center, and we're just getting into your professional life. So you're out of Barnard, you decided to cook. How'd you go about it? Because back in those days, the world was not a cooking oyster for a woman. You know,
yeah,
it wasn't that easy to go in the kitchens you went into. So pray tell, what was your first step?
Spoken from one woman to another.
Yeah.
I could say the same back at you for the path you've carved, but since you're hosting and we're talking about me, I'll give you a knowing glance.
Get your own show, Alex.
A moment of silence for the knowing glance that occurred. I guess my answer is what prescription do you offer with your story? And mine would be that I never really thought about it. You know, and I think that's probably very complex and hard to do now. It was hard then. And sometimes it just smacks you in the face, so you move on, or you don't. You know, I think I mentioned in my cookbook that the second day I was at Guy Savoir in Paris, which was then a 2-star and then became a 3-star Michelin, it was like 1992 or 3. And the guy said to me at the base of the staircase, one of the cooks said, I don't know what's worse, that you're American or that you're a woman. And I thought, well, he's really doing some math here. You know, like he's actually like, pros and cons. He probably had some columns. He made a list of pros and cons. And I thought, well, that's sort of compelling, you know, that they don't know what's worse. And, you know, the French, you know, they are how they are. When you master their language and you're able to really communicate with them, it gets a lot better. And of course, I didn't really have a mastery of the language. So I guess when you say, how did I work in those kitchens? I decided that you had two ways of looking at being a black sheep. I mean, I couldn't really...
Now, how did you get to Gacy?
Oh, so, well, I started at Larry Ford Jones. My mom said, I think before you spend the money on culinary school and you go into debt to do that, you should see if it's actually a field you want to work in, which was so smart. And I mean, advice that I've given a million times over. Go and work in a kitchen for a couple days and see if you actually like it, because I think it's kind of like one of those environments that you either feel feverishly excited about or maybe moderately excited or curious. You don't have to be thrilled. You know, I feel like there's this whole idea that we have to be thrilled all the time about cooking, and it's okay, I think, sometimes to maybe not be so sure. But I think you can also discover whether, you know, that it's just not for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, when people go to school, I think school is critical. I would say 20 years ago, I used to say to people, you don't have to go to culinary school. Just go immerse yourself somewhere.
There's that big debate today. So now, how are you coming down on that?
No, there's no debate for me anymore.
Why? What is it about school?
I think you need the formality of the education in a way that... I think you need a structured, gradual, layered understanding of cooking techniques. And then you can do whatever you want. I don't think just because you cooked 1,000 chickens that you are better off than the person who's sitting in a classroom learning about mother sauces. And I think you'll always have a chance to cook 1,000 chickens now, won't you?
Mm-hmm.
The question is, what happens when the chef is sick and you have to make the sauces? All of a sudden, that notebook of mother sauces and all those resources feed your imagination, because you take that foundation of knowledge, you go into the refrigerator and you say, well, this is what I have, and then here inside of me is what I know. And then you can mix the two, and you end up with 80 choices instead of maybe 10 or 15 that are maybe more mimicking or imitating what you have only seen in the environment where you're working. So I think, you know, it feeds your imagination, and it gives you sort of like a blueprint of knowledge that I think, you know, that's not to say that everybody has to cook French food. You know, but I think it kind of begins with an understanding of all those techniques.
Well, you know, I think one of the things that people don't realize is... the great chefs of Europe went through a formal apprenticeship, which was like a school.
Totally.
And they went through all the different areas they had to, with all the different skill sets that were the basic foundation. And that's what a good school does, is it takes all those things and squishes them down into a digestible format. That's in school, and you're not doing production for the restaurant, but you're learning those foundations. And I know in the first month here, you get 250 skill sets, techniques, and they have to be learned in layers.
That's right.
Know?
That's the important
thing.
And
if you don't learn it in its right sequence, you're not going to master it, because it takes a few things underneath. So it isn't that the school and working in someone's kitchen, because a lot of the skill sets don't get, if you're in a fish kitchen, you know, you're
that's
only
just
gonna learn
it.
Fish. And so I think that debate, we'll take that offline too, is a much more complex debate than people are saying. Go
oh,
to
yeah.
school or learn on the job.
It's expensive.
The school is expensive, and the on the job is hit and miss. How much?
That's it. Well, exactly. And that equation is what people debate.
Right.
There's
right.
no debate for me.
Right.
But I want to say, you got to know whether you want to make the commitment. And I think you can really learn if you look at what you're going to do after you get out of school for a minute first.
Right.
And people say, well, how do I do that? I mean, I have people email me and say, I'd like to come down and just work in your kitchen for a night or two or during the day or whatever. I mean, I just think there are a million ways to kind of expose yourself to the field of cooking and see if you really love it. And I think you should do that first. I really do.
Right.
I think anybody should. And so my mom said, well, go down there and just say you'll work for free. And what are they going to say? No, we don't want you to work for free.
Right.
And that's what I did. I went down there and I said, how are you? And I'd like to work for free and just learn. And they put me in the pastry to start. And I made so many mistakes. I overcooked so much crème anglaise. I burned so many cookies. I made all the classic mistakes.
You weren't free. You were a liability.
Well, I was conservative. I was smart enough to be conservative with my movements and
all
everything
right.
else.
Okay.
I was. And I think I was so overwhelmed that I couldn't have ever been categorized as having a bad attitude. And I think that's a lot of it.
Oh,
you have to remember what a social environment a kitchen is. I mean, being a chef is also being a plumber, an electrician, a counselor, all those other things. But what you're doing is holding together a social network of people and saying, keeping them motivated towards the goal of collaborating to get through dinner service every day. To me, that's actually the number one thing. And to be hopefully inspired in some way that resonates.
So you went to La Varenne.
I did.
How was that?
Well, after a year and a half with Larry Forgione, he said, you need to go to France. He didn't say, you need to go wherever you want, go into the world, this, that. He said, you need to go to France. And I said, why France? And he said, because you've got to see what the world is like if it were perfect.
Wow.
And I thought, well, that's an interesting. It was so compelling to me. And I had taken French in college and high school. So I think I sort of thought, well, I kind of can wing it over there.
Yeah.
I think that's how that kind of magically happened. So I applied to La Varenne for the work study program, thinking, you know what, I'm going to go there and I'm going to save some cash and I'm going to see what the world has to offer. So it was the La Varenne campus in Burgundy that I actually went to, not
Chateau
the one
on
in the Rue Saint-Dominique. I went to the Chateau du Fay and I lived there for 9 months. And I got a grand diplôme from La Varenne, done partially through a lot of heavy dish doing and Pinot Noir drinking. And a lot of it.
Oh, you
from,
poor dear.
Yeah, oh my God. It was so hard.
Bad.
Biting into that Chaurus and drinking that Chardonnay was a really rough life. But I worked very hard, and I was with a group of really fun people, and I got a degree, and I learned really, you know, I learned about, you know, from choux pastry to béarnaise, I really learned all the classics done, you know, taught to me and just, you know, with French ingredients in France. I mean, kind of hard to beat.
In the countryside, so good. I remember visiting Anne there once, and she had a sack of snails, and they all got out. I don't know if you were around then. They were in every nook and cranny, you know, and they
I'm
were
not
supposed
surprised.
To be for cooking. Anyway, let's then you went to Guy Savoy. You also worked for other people over there, didn't you?
Yeah, I worked for another chef in by the French Alps for a while, and then I made my way up to Paris, and I was actually going to come home because I was really broke and kind of grumpy and tired, and I wanted a bagel, and I really did. I just wanted a bagel, and my parents said to me, bagels will be here when you get back. Relax. So my mom said, you know, Patricia Wells, my author, can probably get you in to work at Guy Savoy for a day or two. Go up there and do that, and then come home. So I bought a plane ticket. I arranged to work at Guy Savoy for a couple days through Patricia Wells. And he actually wasn't there the first day. So the second day I came in, and I was sort of thinking, I don't really want to leave this place. I really kind of liked it, even though I have to tell you, friendlier places I have seen. But I found the whole thing so compelling. It was like an orchestra. And there were like 27 guys in there, and I just thought, how did 27 people? I mean, they stood side by side, you know, like cooped up chickens, and they just worked, and it was so graceful.
What was the day like? What was the work day? What were the hours?
I think I usually got there around 7 or 8 a.m., and we would prep, and then we'd have lunch from, say, noon to 2:30 or 3, sometimes 3:30, and then we would clean down the kitchen. And take a break from like 3:30 to 5.
What would you do on your break?
I would drink Coca-Cola. And I think, you know, I wasn't at the time a coffee drinker at all. And I think I just needed, you know, caffeine. I would walk around Paris. I went to the Avenue des Ternes, you know, on the 17th. And I would go to the little market and eat a piece of cheese or some bread or whatever. I mean, everything was so good. I would go to a bakery. And then I would go back. And we would eat dinner and for 5 minutes.
Right.
And then have dinner service. Be done like 11:30, clean up and go home, and then come back and do the same thing.
Physically, how hard was it?
It was really, it was grueling. But, you know, again, I didn't really notice because I liked it, you know, and it just felt natural. But, yes, it was a lot physically. It was. And there were, you know, it was copper pots. And you say, okay, well, big, what's the difference? Well, they're really heavy. So everything was cooked in copper. So if you wanted to heat up water or you wanted to saute an egg or saute in some vegetables or fry an egg or cook a 30-pound fish, you were doing any of that in copper, and it made the lifting.
Especially with the water in it.
Yeah, right, exactly. Boiling water was, you know, let's hope we don't have to boil water today, folks, which is an absurd thing to say.
So when you came back to the States, having that kind of French pedigree and And there's a discipline there in the work stamina thing. Where did you go to work here?
Oh, please.
And what was it like, and how did you feel?
I didn't have any choices, as far as, I mean, you know, when I went straight to Danielle Ballou. My mom took me there for lunch. I left my resume in the kitchen. And Alex Lee, the chef at that time, Danielle, had come to eat at Guy Savoy years before. And I guess one of the service staff told him there was an American in the kitchen and a woman to boot. I guess they told him. So they came back and said to me, Alex Lee is in the dining room eating. And I said, I don't know who that is. And they said, well, he wants to meet you. And I said, okay. So I went out and he said, I'm Alex Lee. I'm the chef at Danielle. When you're done here, come back and work at Danielle. And he gave me his card. And I kept it in my wallet for about 3.5 years, because that's how much longer I stayed in France, maybe 4 years. I don't really remember exactly. So, I mean, I sort of like fished that dirty card out of my wallet. I mean, dirty because it had been sitting there forever. And I went there, you know, like, well, where else am I going to go? And they hired me, and I worked for Danielle for 2 years. And then I thought, I've had enough of Team Frenchalicious, and I need a break. So I bought a one-way plane ticket to California, and I got a job at Patina in Los Angeles, which was at the time a small restaurant on Melrose Avenue in Hollywood, and worked there with a colleague who I had worked with at Danielle and who had worked at Charlie Trotter, Chef David Myers, who has a new restaurant called Hinoki and the Bird in Century City in Los Angeles. And we worked together there for 2 years, and then I thought, well, this is so beautiful, and I love all these heirloom tomatoes, and I love how happy everybody is, but I must go back to New York.
My bagel!
Yeah, I'm a New Yorker.
Yeah.
So I came back and I worked, Joachim opened a steakhouse with Restaurant Associates in the base of Madison Square Garden, and I said, if you pay for my move back, I'll work there. You know, sort of penance, and I didn't have the money, honestly. So there was the motive. Well, what drove you? Well, cash.
The great elixir.
So I worked there for about a year, I think. I don't really remember. And if you don't have anything nice to say, I suppose don't say anything. But after that, I became a private chef for a while, and I started teaching at ICE, and I did that for a while. But So my colleague at ICE said, you know, you've got to go down to Butter. They're looking for a chef. And I said, I don't want to work there. And they said, well, just go and eat dinner. And I went and ate dinner, and it seemed like a lovely place, but it just seemed sort of misguided and confusing to me, but albeit beautiful. Mm-hmm. But I went back in the kitchen, and I saw this one cook. He was cooking scallops, and he turned around, and he was smiling. And I realized he was smiling because he was enjoying the sensation of the sizzling pan and the scallops, and it was making him happy. And I thought, that's it. Sold. And that was 11 years ago.
Wow. All right, well, we're going to take a little break here. When we come back, we're going to ask you, what's professional life, and what's single mom, and how do you have it all? Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story. I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today my guest is Alex Cornicelli. We finally got to the stage. She's the executive chef. Let me just, how many female executive chefs are there in New York City today? What percentage of chefs do you think are female?
Statistically, I don't know. I mean, I think I'm the wrong person to ask, because I think I go out of my way to make sure I know of them or know about that. So maybe as a woman, I look more for it. Yeah. And I'm impressed and happy to see that there are a lot.
There are a lot more, yeah.
I also, it's my understanding that female enrollment in culinary schools is up.
We have always had over 50%.
So and interesting.
I don't know why, as you know, we're very few. And our head chef here is a woman, Candy Argandiza. And our head pastry chef is a man. And in
That's
pastry
awesome.
School, it's 90% women.
Right.
You know? So any of you guys out there who want to meet women, go to pastry school.
Totally.
But anyway, there are a number, a lot more female chefs today, but we're not going to get off on that. How do you describe your food at Butter?
I describe it as French-American food. And I do that by saying that it's really just French techniques underneath it all, which to me obviously makes it I mean, I think I'm because I was taught this code of cooking, I go by it, and I identify, I guess, I associate defining a cuisine a lot with the techniques that were used to build it. But I use such American ingredients, and a lot of ingredients I think that really aren't so great in France. There are ingredients that aren't so great in France that we do better here. For example, crab. For example, beef. Know, that I think, and I think they're inherently, we just kind of say, well, those are American.
Pork.
I'll take the pork too. The lamb, I think the French really, they've got some lamb on them, let me tell you. But if you said pound for pound, you know, I'd take an American chicken. And I'd take American beef.
Would you really?
I would take an American chicken over a volaille de Bresse, but don't tell Georges Blanc. So,
right.
I think, if you mix French techniques with American ingredients, and I think if you have a lot of American dishes, then I think that's kind of how you end up. That's how you end up defining
French technique is. Technique. We have an Italian school now, and we have a Spanish school here, and the Italian school studies French technique, and even when they're in Italy, they study French technique, and I don't think it's French technique. I think the French codify technique.
Right. That's what
and
I
that's
mean.
That's why it's called French technique. So it doesn't necessarily, people then think, oh, is that heavy cream sauce? It has nothing to do
that's
with
right.
the ingredients. And even Ferran Adrià, he studied in France, technique. They all had to study technique, and once you have to know how to, hold a knife. Asian technique is very different.
Right.
But for Western cuisine, it is the technique that the French codified. So, just between us, girls.
I think that's an important distinction to make.
Yeah. So I don't. I'm not sure. I think you do Alex food. I think there's a real. There's a. Sophistication, a nuance, but an elegance in your food.
I like vegetables.
Yeah.
And thank you for saying that. I tell you, Guy Savoy uses a lot of vegetables. And so I learned how to really cook vegetables. And I mean, I had one dish had 15 vegetables on it, and each one was cooked separately. And a lot of them were just blanched and then just gently tossed together in a little butter and lemon. And I cooked... imagine cooking 15 vegetables one by one in different forms. Some were roasted, some were...
In copper pots.
In copper pots filled with water, yes. So I think I really grew to love vegetables for individuality. The other thing is people would materialize at the back door of Guy Savoy, with a basket of mushrooms, porcini mushrooms. Then someone else would come with a crate of asparagus. There was this... The real understanding of Guy Savoy is a person that would do that, buy all these things individually from people. And so I was learning seasonality without realizing it. But there was a day when the porcini mushroom stopped, a day when the asparagus began, and those things were really just the way they were. And you didn't try to get anything above and beyond. And Danielle is the same way. So, and then I moved to California, so think about that. I mean... All the produce, all the fruits. I mean, I really get kind of nutty when I go to the Green Market. But I said to Mark Miller a number of years ago, he said, well, how do you define your cooking? And I said, I'm inspired by the Green Market. And he said, that's not a cooking philosophy. That's a shopping philosophy. And I thought, well, that's brilliant, and I'm going to file that. So I think that made me sort of question, how do you define your cooking? And I think it's not just, yeah, I do think a big part of it is what you buy and where you buy it. Because then that dictates a lot of your choices, I think, but I think the codified French technique, definitely a big tip of the hat in the French direction in a lot of ways, mixed with a lot of American ingredients and that sort of love I have of American cooking. I mean, if you say you thumbed through Fanny Farmer's cookbook and The Joy of Cooking, what would you get? Would you make a blackberry fool, as an example? Would you make a clam chowder? I mean, these are just things I think are very, to me, very American. Mm. And, they're codified in French cooking. They sure are. A crème chantilly, for example, as part of a foule. The definition of a chowder as including some form of pork product and potatoes. These are definitions we come to understand. And I think it's the melding of the two, which is what you grew up, sort of exposed to in your universe, external to my mother's garam masalas, mixed with the techniques and the code of cooking and techniques that I learned, then that's, I think, how I arrive at my own definition.
Wow. That's great. Another hot potato that people talk about is the Food Network being on TV.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Right. And you know, someone like yourself, it's really a shame that all your viewers can't taste your food.
Oh, that's so sweet.
You know? Thank no, you. Truly, because I've known you a long time, and you are just such a delicious cook, you know? And I think people on TV are not taken as seriously as chefs. Because I'll tell
agree.
You, Bobby Flay is a fantastic chef.
Oh, my God,
chef.
Amazing.
He is really a...
It's crazy.
And people belittle him because they don't
care.
Think... I don't care. But, you know, it's that... So tell me about TV and what are the good points? What's attractive to you about doing TV? What are some of the harder things about doing TV?
I think I'm sure there are many actors that would like to make different movies than the ones they make.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, you end up going into something like this thinking, cool, I'm going to get to kind of share who I am and my points of view. And of course, you know, that's a complex thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't always happen that way. And then some things are accidents that, you know, that when I started on Chopped, I never dreamed that it would be sort of educational. But I think, you know, I get so much mail from people about, I never knew this ingredient existed. And now I went out and bought it. And because of what I saw on Chopped and the explanation, I tried it and I love it. And I just thought, well, you know, I thought people would be so caught up in the clock's running out and his leg fell off and whatever else that... The other stuff about the cooking and the ingredients will get lost in the shuffle, but it really hasn't. And so there's ways that things accidentally educate, and I really like that. I like that about the power of television, that it can educate, that we can share common experiences. I like competition shows because I think that they show the human side of people, that people are fallible, that they make mistakes, that people crave being a hero, they crave finding a hero. I mean, I think an Iron Chef is kind of a hero for me. Watching Morimoto make sushi that looks like a stained glass window in a church is just, you know, a memorable moment. Watching Mario Batali burn grappa on the inside of a bowl of Parmigiano Reggiano to, you know, that wheel he carved to make a bowl for tossing pasta. I mean, they're just iconic things that sort of made me realize that the possibilities are endless and that imagination is exciting to watch when it's not your own. So I like the power of all those things. Does that mean that I like all food television? No. But I don't like all books. I don't like all movies.
Absolutely.
I don't like all anything.
Absolutely.
And I would say when you go on television, I think you have to some extent accept that people are going to pigeonhole
right.
you or see you a certain way. I can't really worry about that, provided I'm okay with who I am and what I'm doing myself,
right.
which is a tough audience. You know, your internal audience is your toughest.
It is.
So if someone's going to take pot shots at me, well, they're probably not any worse than the pot shots I've taken at one point or another at myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm interested in negotiating a relationship with my inner me mm-hmm. that's okay with my outer doings
right.
more
so
than anything else. But Bobby Flay, uniquely, when he cooks, it's kind of crazy. It's crazy. And you talk to him while he's cooking, and he starts out engaged, and then he just says, uh-huh. And it's like he gets lulled into the heat of the cooking in the kitchen and whatever else. And that guy, I mean, I've watched him cook, and I've eaten, you know, he's cooked something and then handed it to me, and it's just, you know, how'd you do that? Oh, wait a minute, all that was that and that. How does it taste like this?
You know what, I remember Jacques Pepin, he was taking a lot of heat from some other chefs because he didn't have a restaurant. And they said, oh, you don't have a restaurant, you know, are you really a chef anymore? And he looked at them and he says, you know, I cook more than you do. I'm doing cooking schools, I'm doing on a TV show, I'm cooking. You guys now are all executive chefs. You don't even pick up a knife or a pan anymore.
I think there's a certain idea, a chef's code of what's okay. And chefs need to sit in their restaurants day and night, even if they're walking around with a clipboard drinking coffee,
right.
in their restaurants. And I will say I agree that the presence of the chef or the absence of the chef is felt in
yes.
restaurants,
yeah.
and my own and myself included.
Mm-hmm.
There are times when I get too far away from the restaurant and I say, I got to come back to it. I got to
right.
go back. You know, it's like a fish that the salmon knows it's got to swim upstream
mm-hmm.
and do what it's got to do. I think, you know, chefs, and then, you know, that smacks right up against this wall, this idea that, you know, let's bring the chef out of the kitchen. Let's put him on TV. Let's get him walking around. Let's do this, that. You know, I don't You know, I don't agree with that either. So I have this push-pull internal argument with myself as well, but I'll say this. I enjoy being on TV, and I enjoy the shows that I'm in. I really do. I love Iron Chef America. I love Chopped. I loved my cooking show, Alex's Day Off. I watch the Food Network at home recreationally. My daughter likes Ina Garten the most. She doesn't like me as much, which I think is funny.
How is it being, a lot of people, how is it being a mom chef?
You know, my daughter walks around and says, my mom's a chef and I'm a chef too, and I just think that's the cutest. I don't know, I think, you know, again, remember I said I didn't know I grew up with someone iconic,
yeah,
so
yeah.
They were just mom.
Yeah.
I'm definitely just mom to my daughter. And she says, well, you made something kind of delicious today, Mom. And then sometimes she looks at me and says, can't you just order Chinese food? Can't we just, can we have a bag of Doritos? And I say, totally, let's do it.
Yeah.
So,
do you bring her to the restaurant? Is she in the
sometimes
kitchen with you?
She came, she used to come a little bit more, but she cut her finger. She nicked
Ooh.
It cutting some carrots, and so she's been a little standoffish with me lately, but I have high hopes moving forward.
What happens after school? I mean, in the evenings, you have to be in the kitchen.
I stay home and I cook dinner for her because she eats early.
Ah, right.
So I cook and we eat and we hang out a little bit in the afternoon when she's done, and then I go to work. And some nights I don't go to work.
Actually,
I hang out with her.
Mom. You can, the hours off in between services, yeah.
What doesn't end up being so convenient to normal people is perfectly okay by me.
Right. Well, actually, we've got to get you out of here so you can go pick up your daughter from school.
True.
This is great. It's been wonderful.
A pleasure.
Speaking to you, really.
Thank you.
You are an icon for so many people out there. And I love your philosophy of life. I love your take on the profession. I really expect a lot more greatness from you, Alex.
Well, the feeling's mutual.
Okay, mutual. Gotta go have a drink. Okay, nice to see you. Thanks for listening to Chef Story. A shout out to Jack Inslee and Robin Cohen, my producers. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.